KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Ariel Sabar was one of the first journalists to hear the remarkable news of an ancient manuscript that turned up about 6 years ago. It was a small fragment of papyrus believed to be 1,300 years old. And Karen King, a highly respected scholar at the Harvard Divinity School, was studying the manuscript, which contained this compelling but incomplete phrase, "Jesus said to them, 'My wife.'" Could it be evidence that Jesus had a wife, or at least evidence that early Christians portrayed Jesus as having a wife? Either way, it was explosive. For years now, Sabar has been following the story, which has led him into a rabbit hole that has raised questions not only about the papyrus's authenticity, but the complicated motives of all the players. Sabar will join us today to explain what he's found after the news.
Still thinking about that conversation on StoryCorps? Or the story you caught last weekend on Snap Judgment? The voices you hear on public radio stay with you. You can have a lasting effect on public radio, too. KUER sustainers give ongoing monthly contributions, providing a steady stream of income so we can continue to bring you the programs you can't get out of your head. Become a sustainer today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It would be easy to get caught up in the sensational part of the story Ariel Sabar has been following for years now, that a small fragment of an ancient manuscript that emerges about 6 years ago could be evidence that the historical Jesus of Nazareth had a wife. Now, it's a dramatic claim, of course, with dramatic implications, but there's also a more measured dimension to the story we should point out early on, the careful consideration of a highly respected scholar who has her own doubts about the authenticity of the fragment, but is convinced, at least at first, that there may be something to it. In some ways, the story is about motives, the motives of the scholar and others, the motives of critics, the motives of the man who probably forged the manuscript. That's what Sabar learned after following the story for years now. The results of his reporting appears in the latest edition of The Atlantic. He's joining us today to talk about the story. The article is called "The Unbelievable Tale of Jesus's Wife," and he's joining us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. Ariel Sabar, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Where did you first learn about this story? When did it first come to you?
Well, I'm an author and a magazine freelancer here in Washington, D.C., and I got a call from an editor at Smithsonian Magazine, which was one of the news organizations that had been contacted by the Harvard professor, Karen King, and kind of offered an early look at this papyrus fragment. Before she announced it to the world, she wanted to bring in a few, I guess, you know, respected news organizations to sort of talk them through what it meant, and to try to sort of help them understand it in a way that wouldn't sensationalize the fragment. So yeah. The reporters included me, someone from the New York Times, someone from the Boston Globe, and we were all kind of, you know, given an opportunity separately to sort of speak with her back in 2012, in the fall of 2012.
Right. What did you think of the story then? What did you make of it? Did you think it was, oh, that's just a fascinating thing, or did you start thinking about the implications early on?
You know, I wasn't sure what to make of it. I knew that it would be sensational and controversial one way or another, because there are no other ancient texts that are known anyway that portray Jesus as being married.
Right.
And, you know, I'll sort of admit my own biases here. I'm coming at this a bit of an outsider. I was raised Jewish. So I had to sort of, you know, learn a lot and read a lot to really sort of understand the context of why this would be as explosive as it was. So I was interested in it. You know, I was thrilled to have been included. I was thrilled that Smithsonian Magazine was willing to send me not only to see King at Harvard, but to actually follow her to Rome, where, you know, steps from the Vatican, she would announce this, this controversial discovery to the world. And I think I was the only reporter in the room when she did make this announcement. And I felt, you know, that was very, very exciting to me as a journalist.
All right. Well, we're going to sort of break this down as we go. But let's start with the fragment itself, that this papyrus believed to be this ancient manuscript. Just tell us about the story of the manuscript itself, the document, the fragment itself, at least the story that was being told. of this fragment?
The fragment itself is about the size of a business card. It's, you know, sort of a frayed document with black ink on it. And there aren't all that many words on it. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of partial phrases. We're seeing, we're not seeing complete sentences. So a lot of its meaning is left to interpretation. But what Karen King argued it was implicated in was some sort of dialogue between Jesus and the disciples over whether Mary, and in this case she believes it's Mary Magdalene, was worthy of being Jesus' disciple. And then we have this, of course, this remarkable sort of standout phrase, Jesus said to them, my wife. So it's sort of an argument over whether his wife is worthy of being his disciple.
Now, let's put Karen King in perspective here. And we should be cautious here first. I'm sort of cognizant of the fact that there ought to be kind of disclaimers all over the place. First of all, we should point out Karen King never said the papyrus showed Jesus was married. Only the fragment showed for whatever reason that early Christians seemed to have portrayed Jesus as having a wife. I guess that's important to state that.
Correct. One group of early Christians thought that Jesus was married, and there was some sort of spiritual uplift in that portrayal, that there was something spiritual and transcendent about the idea that that Jesus had a wife.
Yeah. And she stressed, and you point this out in the article, she says the fragment was all but worthless as biography.
Correct.
What does she mean by that?
Well, she means that, you know, we're this fragment at best, and of course these dates wind up changing once the fragment is exposed to various kinds of scientific testing.
Yeah.
But her first hypothesis was that the fragment itself was composed in the 4th century in the language of Coptic, which is an Egyptian language, probably a translation of a 2nd century Greek text. This was her hypothesis initially.
Right.
So even if you take that very early dating, you're still talking about, you know, 150 years after the Jesus lived.
Yeah.
So we can't, and she never attempted to credit it as having any kind of biographical value. It was just simply composed too late after Jesus's life to tell us much in the way of history.
Explain why she's interested in this subject, because you mentioned that the fragment fits into her line of study, which you describe in the article as resurrecting the diversity of voices in the early days of Christianity.
Sure. I mean, Karen King would tell you that she's sort of an unabashedly feminist scholar.
Yeah.
And one of her focuses over the years has been kind of these lost gospels, gospels that didn't make it into the sort of official New Testament, into the canonical New Testament. So, you know, it turns out there were a lot of other gospels out there, aside from, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Right.
And a lot of these Gospels we didn't really know anything about for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years, because a lot of them were literally either thrown in the trash or buried in the sands of Egypt, because if you were found holding one of these things, you would, you know, you were guilty of, heresy.
Yeah.
In the last 100 years on the antiquities market and also just by sheer luck, farmers digging in the deserts of Egypt and turning up these lost gospels in clay vessels, we're discovering that there are all these other texts that purport to be about Jesus' life. And they were written, you know, fairly early on. And a number of these texts offer different interpretations of the meaning of Jesus' life and teachings. And the texts that have been particularly compelling to Karen King have been those that focus on portrayals of women in Jesus' life. And of course, one of the most important women in Jesus' life, I think you'd have to say would be Mary Magdalene.
Sure.
And so she's looked at a number of these kind of so-called Gnostic texts or non-canonical gospels, including the so-called Gospel of Philip and the Gospel of Mary, that have given Mary Magdalene a more prominent role than the one you'd see in the canonical gospels in the life of Jesus as a kind of confidant, as a kind of chief disciple. And so we're getting kind of a different look at who Mary Magdalene was than what you just get if you relied on the 4 traditional gospels.
Mary Magdalene is often the focus of the conversation. Karen King, Elaine Pagels, there are others who are really interested in this role of women in early Christianity. We'll get into this a little bit later, but there's also kind of a pop cultural more sensational part of this story, which sort of is reflected in, you know, Dan Brown's story that that plays out in The Da Vinci Code. Would you just say something about that? Because that is an interesting element that, again, we sort of will get back to in the story.
Yeah, I mean, The Da Vinci Code was this, you know, mega bestseller thriller written by Dan Brown. You know, I think it's one of the best-selling books of all time. Yeah. And it got a lot of attention because it portrayed, you know, this long-hidden secret of Jesus's marriage to Mary Magdalene and a Harvard professor, fictional Harvard professor, who discovers this secret and this secret society that's been protecting this, you know, this information for hundreds of years, and then eventually tracks down the alleged descendants of Jesus and Mary Magdalene in the present. So there's this kind of huge pop culture backdrop at the very moment that Karen King winds up announcing this discovery. And I think that people sort of scratch their heads and said, okay, this is kind of interesting here, but it seems almost too of the moment. It seems like an artifact made for our own time. And, you know, having spent some time while researching my story, looking into the history of you know, controversial manuscripts and forgeries, one of the tells of a forgery is that it seems almost too perfect for its time. It seems to speak to a contemporary cultural concern or issue. And for some folks, the fact that this is coming out while The Da Vinci Code is still fresh in people's mind is a reason to be a little suspicious.
Right. What are the stakes associated with this idea that Jesus had a wife? Because you mentioned in the article, if in fact he did have a wife, when the fragment was first revealed to the world, it set off this shockwave. And that, as you put it in the article, centuries of Christian tradition are bound up in whether the scrap is real. I mean, the stakes are really high here.
Yeah, they are. I mean, even if you don't accept it as biography, you know, for centuries, the church, particularly the Roman Catholic Church, has said that, you know, Christianity, I mean, that the New Testament has essentially been handed down from God through a long succession of men. Right. You know, Jesus to his apostles, to the popes, to the bishops, to the priests. And, you know, they sort of invoke the all-male cast of apostles and the presumption, really, that Jesus was a celibate bachelor to justify things like priestly celibacy, yeah, to justify the exclusion of women from the priesthood. And, you know, all these things aren't necessarily rooted in history. You know, they're rooted in later portrayals of whether Jesus might or might not have been single. In fact, we don't hear from anybody that Jesus was either single or married until about 100 years after his life, when one of the early church fathers says that there are a number of early Christians who are practicing celibacy because Jesus was celibate. But if you look at the Gospels themselves, they don't really say that. And in fact, a lot of historians feel that because, you know, Jesus was Jewish and that most Jewish men were married, it would be perfectly reasonable to imagine that Jesus was married. But that doesn't wind up becoming the tradition of the Orthodox churches, particularly the Roman Catholic Church. So what's bound up in this is really the role of, you know, of women in the church, yeah, and whether women can hold the highest positions within the church. And I think what the papyrus suggests is that there were voices, you know, fairly early on in Christianity that said, yeah, I mean, Mary Magdalene was worthy of discipleship. So why should women who came after her be denied so lofty a role?
Yeah. You also mentioned, just briefly here, that it also raised this question about whether a person could be holy and sexual.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a question that still this sort of division or this conflict between, you know, our sexuality and our holiness and our divinity, and can those two things be reconciled? And I think, you know, the idea that, you know, I think she says that she feels, Karen King feels, that this papyrus also spoke to this larger debate that I think still is at play over whether sexuality is kind of inherently sinful. Mm-hmm. In order to kind of, you know, connect with the divine, do we have to turn away from the earthly? Do we have to turn away from the fleshly or from the flesh? Or can those two things actually be reconciled? Can sexuality be holy in a way? Are there ways in which, if Jesus himself was married, that we can say that marriage rather than celibacy is the ideal mode of Christian life?
And this question that particular question or a version of that question, you know, the question of sex, becomes one of these motives that really complicates the story that we'll sort of get to here in a moment. But I sort of mentioned in the introduction that a lot of the article does raise these big questions about motives. Are you with me on that? Is that true? I mean, that question of motives seems a big one.
I think it is, and I think you addressed that well in your introduction. And we have a lot of motives at play here. We have the motives of Karen King. We have the motives of whoever it was that gave her this papyrus. And I have a feeling we'll talk about him later.
Yeah,
we will, to the
degree to which you feel comfortable, by the way. Ariel, I should have mentioned, I'm not sure how much we should give away, and I'll sort of let you guide me as to how much we should.
Okay? Okay, sure, sure. Yeah. But I think also the other question is the motives of the scholars who were very quick to dismiss this as being obviously a forgery. I think, you know, there's so much at stake here that everyone comes out of the woodwork and has a dog in a fight in a way. And that's what makes this, for me, such a rich story to cover.
Ariel Sabar is with us, a journalist and a writer. His article, The Unbelievable Tale of Jesus's Wife, appears in the July-August edition of The Atlantic. That's the latest. You can get a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. It's fascinating, so you should have a look. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're talking about this crazy, fascinating story of this ancient fragment, a piece of papyrus that turns up about 6 years ago and was believed by some to be actual proof that Jesus had a wife. Karen King, a highly respected scholar at the Harvard Divinity School, was studying the manuscript, published a paper about it. And our guest today is the journalist Ariel Sabar, who has spent years really running the story down. The results of his exploration is in the latest edition of The Atlantic magazine. We have a link to it on our website. It's got all the elements of a good story: history, dodgy characters, of course, sex. Sabar is joining us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. All right, let's talk about Karen King. When does she first hear about and see the fragment?
Karen King first hears about the fragment in July of 2010. It's summer break at Harvard, and she gets this email from a man who identifies himself as a manuscript collector. Yeah. And he tells her that he has a number of old papyri, including one that seems to suggest a particularly close relationship between Jesus and Mary Magdalene.
Right. And at this point, and this is where it gets kind of interesting in this sense, where does she figure this thing came from? Because there's a theme in the story, this question of provenance. And in some ways, it seems like scholars are kind of ambivalent. I don't know if that's the right way to put it, but with all the scientific testing going on the fragment, and this is something that seems like one of the insights you sort of bring to this story, you're wondering, well, why isn't anyone bothering to vet the ownership of the fragment and where this fragment comes from? Would you talk about that part of the story, this question of provenance?
Of course. So provenance is just a fancy way of saying chain of ownership. You know, who owned this art object or this papyrus? When and where did it exchange hands? How much did people pay for it? Ideally, if you can do it really well, you trace it back to the place where it was sort of initially dug out of the ground.
Right.
And in this case, we never really had much information about provenance. Number one, the papyrus's owner requested to remain anonymous, and Karen King honored that request. She knew who he was, but she would not disclose his identity to anybody else. The story he told her about where the papyrus came from involved a set of professors and collectors, all of whom were dead. So that made it very difficult to go back and ask any of them whether they had actually ever bought or seen or owned or vouched for this papyrus. And so there was, it was this story that, was very, very hard for anyone to kind of check up on. And that made it very, it left this big, it left the papyrus exposed in many ways, because even though Karen King would wind up doing these very sophisticated scientific tests, carbon-14 dating, multispectral imaging, what had never really been done was an investigation of the owner himself and where he got the papyrus from and who he was.
Yeah.
And that's what sort of wound up, you know, gnawing at me. Years after I wrote these first stories for Smithsonian Magazine, I kept thinking, you know, we still have this debate over whether this fragment is real. And there have been tons and tons of resources poured into scientific testing. But no one's asking questions about provenance. And I think, you know, you asked a good question. Why not? I mean, academics are good at asking all kinds of questions. I think in some ways it's a question of training and methodology. Yeah. I think academics are great at doing work in laboratories and in libraries. That's where their strengths are. That's where their expertise comes in handy. They're not so great at what I think journalists are trained to do sort of from the very start of their careers, which is to, you know, pick up the phone, knock on the doors of strangers, mm-hmm. you know, travel to places and ask questions of people who have never been asked questions before, you know, rifle through public documents, chase down paper trails in the public record. This doesn't, I think, come as naturally to academics. And I think that's why there was this kind of blind spot that I don't think just afflicted King. I think it afflicts a lot of professors who are accustomed to working in the environment of a university.
At what point does Karen King decide that she was willing to, you know, to risk her reputation for this story?
So Karen King, you know, she occupies, I think, the oldest endowed professorship of any kind in all of North America, this Hollis Professorship of Divinity at Harvard. It's like something like 295 years old. It's very prestigious. So she's used to getting emails from people with all kinds of kooky ideas. I mean, she told me in 2012 that, you know, a woman emailed her claiming to be Mary Magdalene. Another man claimed that he had some secret code that would unlock all of the Bible secrets. And so when she first got this email, she's like, okay, here comes another one.
Yeah.
You know, this is probably a forgery. I probably shouldn't even waste my time with it. But, you know, I'll ask this guy to give me a little bit more information about it. If he wants to send me some photographs, fine. But she's pretty skeptical at the beginning.
And it's interesting. Like, I wonder how much of a risk is this for her? I mean, she's really transparent about the process. You make that clear in the article. Except for revealing the owner, at least at first, you know, she keeps that sort of to herself. But she was very transparent about the possibility of this being a forgery. So on one hand, she's practicing due diligence. But then there's this other part of this story. She decides to give it this incredibly dramatic title, the paper.
Yes.
The Gospel of Jesus' Wife. She decides to go to Rome on the steps of the Vatican. So there's this sort of careful consideration on one hand, and there's this kind of appeal to the dramatic, and that seems interesting in this story.
It does. And, you know, I think, I mean, I was in the room the day after she announced her find in Rome, and there was this crush of reporters, including, you know, a reporter from some of the biggest Italian newspapers. And one of them asked her that question point blank, you know, aren't you making a statement by announcing this, you know, literally across the street from, you know, St. Peter's Basilica?
Yeah.
And her response was actually, no, it's just coincidence. There was a once every 4 year international conference of Coptic scholars. It happened to be held in Rome this year. It happened to be held across from the Vatican. This just was a good place for me to announce this. It was justified in terms of, you know, what the topic of the conference was about. There was nothing that you should read into this. Now, I think, you know, I think people can ask their own questions about whether that's true or not. Clearly, you know, she could have announced it in a way that would have made less of a splash, you know, perhaps just put out a press release, not travel to Rome, announce it at a different conference. So, yes, on the one hand, and she has a reputation as being a very careful, very methodical scholar. On the other hand, I think she was aware very early on that this would make a very, very big splash. Yeah. And the fact that she I think with the help of the Harvard Divinity School's public relations department, wanted to give some reporters an early look at the fragment, suggested that there was a bit of thinking about how this would play out in the public imagination. Not to suggest that there was anything untoward about it, but that there was a sense of that there would be a certain amount of drama and intrigue.
What was the initial reaction from colleagues? Because you say doubts and critiques came pretty quickly.
Yeah, they came fairly quickly. I mean, I remember, you know, right after she gave the talk, one gentleman, you know, scholar stood up and applauded, but others were kind of scratching their heads as they were looking over very, very high resolution images of the fragment on their iPads, and immediately began finding aspects of the Coptic handwriting, problems with the Coptic grammar that just seemed a little off. There were a number of errors that raised questions. Also, the handwriting seemed a little bit strange. It didn't seem quite right for this kind of document. And so, you know, very quickly we're seeing some very strong reactions against the papyrus's authenticity. Not surprisingly, right. The Vatican came out very, very quickly and labeled it a clumsy forgery,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, inept.
And they said,
yeah.
No, none of this would change, you know, even if it were authentic, none of this would change, you know, a single thing about centuries of Christian tradition. So they were very, very quick to sort of condemn the scrap, which I suppose we shouldn't be surprised about. What was more interesting for me was the reaction of other experts in Coptic and papyrology to this very intriguing bit of papyrus.
Wait, what do you mean? Explain. They thought it was authentic.
I mean, you know, there were a group of, and we should say this because it's important. Karen King didn't just sort of take this fragment that the collector gave to her and kind of run it out into the world without some due diligence. She went to some of the top experts in the world on Coptic language and in papyrology. And they gave her assurances that, you know, this thing looks authentic. Mm-hmm. We can't find any obvious evidence of forgery. But it wasn't uniform. There was at least one scholar who was sent a copy of Karen King's draft article on the papyrus for the Harvard Theological Review, who said, no, this should not enter the world. This is rife with problems. Let's put the brakes on this. And, you know, and so I think that there was an early sense that every single person who looked at this thing before she went public thought it was golden. And I think what I discovered in doing my own reporting was that there actually were people who raised flags early on, but whose objections were kind of overcome by King and by the other scholars who thought that this thing was very, very likely authentic.
So when do you figure, Ariel Sabar, that you are going to devote so much time to this? When do you figure this question of provenance again comes up? And as you say in your article, you were noticing that there wasn't a lack of information, just a lack of an investigation. And you decided to do it yourself.
I did. I mean, I had moved on after 2012 and my Smithsonian stories came out. I had moved on to other projects, other stories, completely unrelated. But it was a big enough story that, you know, like a lot of reporters, we like to keep track of what the latest developments are. And every few months or every year or so, there would be another scientific test or another scholarly publication that was weighing in on this question of authenticity. And it seemed like people were pretty dug in, you know, on their positions. Karen King said, you know what? My scientific tests show that these are authentic. Her critics said, you've got to be kidding me. There are so many problems with this text. It looks like not only that the Coptic grammar and handwriting are off, but it looks like the scribe would have been using a brush instead of a pen, like a reed pen, which also was just completely anachronistic.
It was cut and pasted from another gospel.
Yeah, it looked like many phrases looked like they were literally lifted from the Gospel of Thomas and just reassembled into a pastiche that gave it this completely new meaning. And there was just this kind of stalemate. And part of me thought, you know, I guess somewhat privileged to have early access to Karen King. She, in fact, very graciously back in 2012, when I asked her if she could share with me the emails that the owner had sent to her when he was sort of hoping to entice her to champion his papyrus, whether she could send me those emails. She very graciously did. She took out his name. She took out his email, any identifying details. But there was this really interesting email chain that, you know, that showed this very kind of sophisticated courtship of King, a little bit slippery too. And it kind of weighed on me. I just felt like I had this material that might help do something small to move the debate forward. And no one had really asked hard questions. Some people had certainly asked questions about provenance, but I don't think any other reporters or scholars had the resources of a major magazine behind them that was willing to say, okay, you know what? Your instinct here is pretty good. Why don't you travel to Germany? Why don't you travel to Florida? Why don't you travel wherever you need to go to really nail this down?
Yeah. As we've already talked about, Professor King never did rule out the possibility of this being a forgery, but she was doubtful, at least early on, that it was. And she thought it was unlikely that you would have, on one hand, the sophistication required to pull something like that off, and then the kind of ineptness to make the mistakes that were there. But you say that that combination of sophistication and bumbling is not so uncommon, and you bring up the character of Mark Hoffman, a name that people here in Utah are going to recognize, this infamous and gifted forger who had both of those elements, had the gifts, had the sophistication, but also was a bit of a bumbler too.
That's right. That's right. I mean, you know, there is this always an arms race, you know, for since the beginning of sort of published text, really, between the skills and the sophistication of forgers and the scholars or experts who would expose them. So each is trying to sort of outmaneuver the other. And as our, you know, as science gets better, as the sophistication of sleuthing and you know, forensics gets better, forgers have to adapt and get better themselves to outmaneuver the academics and those who would unmask them. And I think, you know, Mark Hoffman is a classic case where, you know, who is someone who is extremely sophisticated, not only in chemistry and in how to make a allegedly historical document look historical by buying old paper, by producing ink with ancient recipes, by using various chemical solutions to artificially age his manuscripts. Mm-hmm. But he also did things like immerse himself, this is Mark Hoffman, immerse right. himself so deeply in the writings of Joseph Smith that he could almost channel his style of thinking and his style of writing. And then he does himself one better, because he presents himself to forensic examiners and to scholars as this kind of bumbling scholar. I think the New York Times called him a scholarly country bumpkin. Yep. He comes across as very modest. He doesn't really know whether his documents are authentic. Oh, please, you know, Mr. Forensic Examiner, will you tell me if they're authentic? I can't really tell. And so it's very, very disarming. And, you know, you really, to succeed as a forger, I think, in the 21st century, in the 20th century, really, even, you have to have you have to be firing on all cylinders. It's not enough just to be able to produce a document that looks authentic. You have to be able to channel the thoughts of the person whose ideas you're trying to place on that document. You have to present yourself to the world as someone who's credible, disarming, who doesn't have any real stake. And I think Mark Hoffman is an example of someone who was able to pull the wool over the eyes of some of the United States' at the time most sophisticated scholars and forensic examiners.
And you say in the article you were seeing connections between Hoffman and the emails sent to Professor King, and where you have these forgers who are able to manipulate the kind of the interests of their victims, the vulnerabilities.
Sure.
And not to mention that, you also say, you know, these forgers also have their own personal grudges that they're trying to satisfy.
They do, and I do. I mean, and one of the things that I think Mark Hoffman did, which really speaks to that, is that, you know, initially the documents that he began selling the Mormon Church were ones that affirmed the kind of foundational sort of official history of the Mormon Church. So the Mormon Church was very, very interested in buying his documents because they seemed to sort of back the story, the official story of the Mormon Church. But then what he started doing was forging documents that would upend that history.
Yeah.
And then the Mormon Church had other motives for wanting to buy and in some cases suppress those documents. And so, yes, there was a sense in which I began seeing even in the emails to Karen King from the owner of the Gospel of Jesus' Wife, a similar persona, mm-hmm. This kind of country bumpkin sort of persona. He claims, you know, he addresses her, even though she's this very, very big professor at Harvard, he doesn't call her Dr. King or yeah. Professor King. He addresses her as Mrs., which is just very, very bizarre for someone, even a manuscript collector, who manuscript collectors tend to be very sophisticated, to refer to a Harvard professor as Mrs. King, mm-hmm. basically denoting her marital status. It just was very, very odd. On the one hand, he says that he doesn't understand Coptic, that he has no idea about what this manuscript says. He can't tell her whether it's authentic or not. And then almost in the same breath, he undoes every single thing he says. He says, actually, I can tell you exactly what the manuscript says. My translation of the manuscript seems to make pretty good sense. And if you do scientific testing on it, please do it in a way that only uses a few shreds of the papyrus so that it doesn't damage the fragment. So he's a man who is simultaneously kind of bumbling and sophisticated. And I think that that's a strategy that forgers use to kind of disarm their marks.
And he knew that she was interested in this early sense of women in Jesus. I mean, that seems like something he would be willing to exploit as well.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt that if you had an ancient manuscript that suggested that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene, you could not have chosen a better professor to sell that to. I don't mean literally sell it to, but bring that to than Karen King, whose entire or most of whose career is devoted to just such texts. And so particularly if you were looking for a very, very high profile scholar, you couldn't do better than Karen King.
Ariel Sabar is with us, journalist and writer. His article, The Unbelievable Tale of Jesus's Wife, appears in the most recent issue of The Atlantic magazine. There's a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the writer and journalist Ariel Sabar. We're talking about his article in the latest issue of The Atlantic magazine, The Unbelievable Tale of Jesus' Wife. He's joining us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. Okay, we sort of danced around this shadowy figure for a while. Let's talk a little bit about him, at least to the degree you feel comfortable, Ariel Sabar. When do you find out who this person actually is? Because you have to do a lot of digging to get there.
Yeah, no, I spent probably about six months researching the story in The Atlantic, and it didn't come until fairly late that I was able to get confirmation and identify and then actually have the owner admit to me that he was the owner. And that wasn't easy because when I first called this gentleman, who lives in Southwest Florida, he lied to me. He said, I'm not the owner. I have nothing to do with this. I can't help you, and I can't even tell you who the owner is. And so that left me a little frustrated because I had a hunch that he might at least have known who the owner was because of his relationship with the gentleman who owned the papyrus fragment before him. And that gentleman's name had been made public. And so, you know, I was a little frustrated. I had traveled to Florida hoping to knock on his door. I wasn't able to do that because he had this, you know, guard dog out front, and there was a gate that didn't permit entry, and there was no intercom, no doorbell to ring. And so all I'm left with is his phone number. I call him, and he's like, yeah, I can't help you. So, you know, I had been a newspaper reporter for many, many years. I had done other investigative stories before, and I know that when, you know, you have a good hunch and the subject of that hunch, in this case, the person who I thought might be connected to the Jesus' Wife papyrus, won't talk to you, what you have to do is start looking for other evidence. You have to essentially start building a kind of dossier against the person. And then when you go back to them, they can no longer lie to you because you essentially have the goods. Yeah. I mean, you don't necessarily have the goods that they own the papyrus, but you know that they have studied, for instance, Coptic, that they attended an Egyptology program in Germany, at the very same university of the other professors who allegedly looked at this fragment back in the 80s. You discover that he had worked at museums. You discover that he had this very interesting personal life that involves, you know, kind of the swinger scene in Florida, but also involves internet pornography, and that some of that pornography involves stars his own wife. And then you also learn, I don't want to disclose too much because I want people to read the story.
Yeah, I agree.
But I think it's worth mentioning that this gentleman's wife herself considers herself a kind of a mystic who channels the voice of God and the Archangel Michael. And so when I start putting all these pieces together, I start thinking, you know, this guy probably has something to do with the Gospel of Jesus' Wife. If he's not the owner, then he certainly knows who the owner was. So With a combination of kind of old-fashioned shoe-leather reporting, knocking on doors in Florida and in Germany, public documents research, internet sleuthing, and library research, I'm able to kind of build enough of a case against him that when I call him about 4 months after he first lies to me, he now tells me, okay, so what do you want to know?
Right.
So at that point, he's like, okay, this guy, I need to deal with this guy. Yeah. I can no longer credibly lie to him or get it. And so that winds up becoming a turning point. And eventually, after I think something like 12 hours of interviews, he says, you know, check your email inbox for a statement. And that statement winds up filling me in on just this amazing list of details that I wind up, building some of the story on top of.
People have to read the article to get the particulars. It's fascinating the way you work through all of this. And you sort of fall down this rabbit hole, as you put it, and the story gets really sorted, as you, I think, alluded to there. Lewd and learned is how you put it in the article. It's interesting, though. We could talk about this person's motives a bit. And it's interesting that money problems come into play. That's one thing. And also this idea of sex comes into play as well. And this is when I like how you involve your wife in this part of the story in the question of her raising. She's like, honey, do you not know anything about the Da Vinci Code? And I guess you really didn't. I mean, she's seeing the connections, but you didn't get caught up in it when it first came out. Will you tell this part of the story?
Yeah, sure. So I didn't, I was aware of the Da Vinci Code as a cultural phenomenon. I was aware of vaguely aware of this idea that there was this plot involving a marriage between Jesus and Mary Magdalene. But beyond that, I hadn't read it at all.
Yeah.
And I think my wife had read it as part of a book club, and we were on, it was the winter holidays, and we were driving to the in-laws' house, and she said, all this stuff you're telling me about the owner and his sex life and the role his wife plays in that, have you actually read the Da Vinci Code? And I said, no, do I need to? And she said, yeah, you need to read this because it might just bring everything into focus for you. And I hadn't realized that the Da Vinci Code actually, these sort of kind of bizarre sex rights play a role in the book, that there's a Harvard professor in the book who's a professor of religious symbology. This is starting to sound a little bit like Karen King. There's a reason for that. Mm-hmm. And that this Harvard professor in the Da Vinci Code winds up discovering the descendants, the modern descendants of Jesus and Magdalene, thanks to a cryptic message on a scrap of papyrus. And I'm going, holy moly. There's so much here that seems to be parallel to the story in the Da Vinci Code that I wonder whether it is just a coincidence. And so that made me wonder whether the Da Vinci Code itself may have planted a kind of seed in the mind of the owner that, maybe we can take what is essentially a work of fiction and turn it into fact.
Yeah.
Or into what is perceived as fact.
Perceived as fact, right. The other dimension of this article, you say that in some way this person who gives this fragment to Karen King that, in 2010 could be in some way trying to sanctify this adventurous sex life he has with his
right.
Wife.
I mean, I think there's and we should be very clear that this the owner of the papyrus has denied to me in writing and in interviews that he forged the papyrus.
Right.
I want to be very clear about that.
Yeah.
I mean, there are suspicions out there, but I want to be clear that he himself denies altering it in any way. I think that that's an important point. And I think that some people wondered whether this papyrus was an attempt to embarrass Harvard or to embarrass Karen King. I happen to think, with the research I've done, that it's quite the opposite, that whoever forged this actually shared many of the views that Karen King does about the role of women in the early church, about the importance of Mary Magdalene as one of Jesus's closest confidants, and about the Catholic Church's suppression of women, and that I think that the forgery, or if it is finally definitively determined to be a forgery, was actually sort of thought of as perhaps as a gift to Karen King. Mm-hmm. Here's something you can show the world that, in the clearest terms possible, I shouldn't say that, but in fairly clear terms, has Jesus referring to a wife, and isn't this the to use another term that that is oft cited in the Holy in the Da Vinci Code, the kind of the holy grail of the work you've been doing your entire career. Let me help you tell that story more effectively than you ever have. And I think that, again, this gets back to why someone who had a fragment like this would bring it to Karen King, because more than I think any other scholar, she would be predisposed to give it the time of day. Not that she would, you know, be careless about it, but she would give you the time of day on this fragment that perhaps another scholar would not.
Karen King would not talk to you before you did the article. I mean, about the article itself, the particulars of you know, digging all this out. I mean, in the end, she didn't seem terribly resentful of the article when you finally did talk to her. She said it was fascinating, it was helpful, but she wasn't terribly helpful to you early on about that, and that seemed odd. What do you make of that?
You know, I wasn't sure what to make of that. I actually thought that after having done months of research in an area, that this area of provenance or ownership that she had not focused on, that she would be very interested in hearing what I'd found. And I was really interested in hearing what she thought about it, because before going to publication, I wanted to say, you know, ask her, well, you know, do you think this is important? Do you think any of this bears on the question of authenticity? Does it color your view of the papyrus in any way? And I called her saying, you know, can we just meet somewhere? We don't need to do this in a rushed way. And she said, I haven't engaged the provenance questions at all. I'm not interested in talking. I have nothing to contribute. And I said, well, aren't you interested in hearing what I found? And she said, not particularly. And to me, I was a little puzzled by that. I didn't understand why a scholar who had devoted so many resources to the question of authenticity wouldn't be curious, especially since I think she – you know, she had read my earlier stories for Smithsonian, and I think, you know, she sent me some notes afterward that said that they were quite fair, and she'd enjoyed working with me on the story. So it was a little bit puzzling. And I think the only – I mean, I really can't speak for her motivation in that moment, except to say that I think that she had started to feel under attack, that she – that there were so many scholars that were already arguing in peer-reviewed journals that this thing was a forgery. You know, I think that she – I think she started to think that people – too many people had an axe to grind and that she wasn't going to engage anymore, because engaging would only lead to her being portrayed unfairly or getting hurt in some way that would impede the important scholarship she was doing. And in her defense, I think she was coming in for a lot of criticism.
Yeah.
And I think she was started feeling a little bit shell-shocked by all of it.
Well, she told you the article made her feel – or at least told someone that the article made her feel relieved.
Well, that was the interesting thing, because as soon as the article came out and I had emailed – you know, she was one of the first people I emailed the story to. You know, I said, look, I'm still open to having a conversation. I realize the story is published, but I'm the lines of communication are open here. If you do have an opinion about it, if you want to chime in – give me a call. And, you know, to her credit, she called me that the very afternoon that it posted to the Atlantic's website and said, I didn't know any of these details. Yeah. I had no idea who this guy was, that the owner was. And she felt lied to, and she felt that, you know, she felt that the story was helpful. And I you could have found someone who had a very different reaction, who didn't want to talk about it, who would shut down. And I think, to her credit, and I think, you know, I think this shows that she is a very, very good historian, that, you know, once she is presented with new kinds of evidence, she's willing to reassess her early hypotheses. And she winds up saying to me, and this winds up making, you know, news, that she now thinks that the weight of the evidence points in the direction of forgery. And that was the first time she said that. Before then, she'd always argued that, sure, there was a small chance it could be a forgery, but probably not. As a result of what she read in the story, I think she now feels that the weight of the evidence points in the direction of this being a fake.
The dean of Harvard Divinity School, David Hempton, released this statement. And it was interesting. He expressed gratitude to scholars and technicians and journalists. I suppose that means you. And he also said that they would continue to treat these questions with seriousness. But it was interesting. The statement did not say the school or Professor King had made any grave mistakes of judgment. How do you react to that statement?
I mean, I think that that's ultimately something that the scholarly community needs to judge, whether that response was sufficient or not. I can tell you that, you know, I've been monitoring, you know, the Twitter accounts of various scholars, and I think a lot of other scholars in the field were disappointed by that statement because, and by the statement by the Harvard Divinity, by the Harvard Theological Review, which was the journal that had published King's initial article, that they would not retract her article. They felt that, you know, scholarship should not be engaged in promoting a forgery, and that that there was a need to maybe perhaps take a stronger stand and to make a more forceful statement. But I do think that that's not a question necessarily for journalists to answer, but one that the scholarly community needs to reckon with,
yeah.
You know, whether it's enough to say, okay, I now believe it's a forgery and sort of move on, or whether the additional step of actually making a formal retraction of her article in the Harvard Theological Review is warranted.
King said she didn't see any reason to retract the paper. She told the Boston Globe she saw scholarship as a conversation.
Yeah, and that, I think that that's certainly true. But then the question is, well, after at what point in the conversation do you reach you know, a conclusion?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I think that the Harvard Theological Review is saying that they had never taken a position on authenticity, that they were merely giving King a forum to publish this thing, and that they'd also published a critical article by another scholar who had disputed her findings. But I think that that actually doesn't square with my own reporting back in 2012, in which the Harvard Theological Review explicitly held Karen King's paper for something like a year and a half because they weren't convinced of authenticity. They didn't want to publish her article until scientific tests came back showing that this was unlikely a forgery. So now they're saying, well, it doesn't really matter whether it was authentic or not because we never said it had to be authentic to be published. And I think that I suspect that we haven't heard the end of that story. I believe that there will be some pushback from leading scholars, biblical scholars, against the decision of the Harvard Theological Review to simply say we're good here. We don't need to do anything more than what we already have done.
That's Ariel Sabar, journalist and writer. His article is The Unbelievable Tale of Jesus' Wife. It appears in the latest edition of The Atlantic magazine. You can get a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. He joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Ariel, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks so much.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.